This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
So it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You are listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is off today. Let's have a quick check in here on markets. You got the FTSE 100 closing up by 0.8%. The CAC closing up over 1%. The DAX up about 0.5%. And Euro Stoxx 50 up by 1%. Pretty solid day in the equity market. Volume, though, pretty terrible. We'll talk about that in just a second. A lot of things going on. You got the European Commission feeling a little more optimistic on growth for Europe. Maybe not Germany, but definitely when it comes to Europe. You have war of balloons happening between the U.S. and China, although supposedly maybe U.S. and China are going to meet at the table for the first time after shooting down four balloons over the U.S. and Canada. Let's see. We got CPI tomorrow. We also have a Eurozone GDP for the fourth quarter coming out tomorrow as well. We get wages and jobs in the U.K. coming out tomorrow. There's stuff. There's a lot of stuff happening. Luckily, I am joined by Andrew VanderVault, one of my favorite people, joining me for the hour. It's true. And we'll talk about
other things, Alex,
than just commodities. There's also some sports stuff that we're going to pretend to know things about. Eddie, thanks for joining.
Well, absolutely. I will have to pretend a little bit on the football front. But look, there is absolutely so much going on, as you say. It feels like the macro is back. Last week, there was a little bit of a dearth of macro news. But this week, particularly around that big CPI number, I feel like the market will be starting to pay attention to the big macro signals and will therefore pick big trading directions. And therefore, I think this week is really, really exciting.
Funny, because I was saying some people on TV were saying that they prefer if the micro took hold and maybe it's more the micro. So I like this debate. That's how you make a market. All right. That's a quick snapshot of what we're going to be looking at over the next hour. Now let's get some more headlines with Charlie Pellett.
Hi. Thank you very much, Alex. Here's what's going on. More than 1,800 bus drivers employed by Abellio in London have accepted a pay deal giving workers with more than 2 years service an 18% pay rise. The Unite Union says workers with sufficient experience will now be paid $18 an hour, an increase of 18% on the basic rate. A couple of other stories that are developing. Top U.S. and China diplomats are weighing their first meeting since the balloon drama. And Liberty Global says it has acquired a 49% stake in UK-based Vodafone Group in a bet that the company's plans to sell assets and revamp its business will lead to an increase in the share price. The stock up 2.1% today in London. And Prime Minister Sunak says the government will do whatever it takes to protect the country as the UK announces a security review after several unidentified objects were shot down in the skies over North America. Asked about those objects, Sunak said he would not comment in detail on security matters, but people should be reassured that we have all the capabilities in place to keep the country safe, including a quick reaction force of Typhoon fighter jets. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
All right, Charlie, I do not feel better when leaders say that. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Okay, let's get to one of the interesting things that happened out of Europe. I do feel like, to be honest, we're waiting for CPI on Wednesday, but I don't want to discount what the European Commission said about growth. Overall, the European Commission raised their growth forecast for this year, now looking at a 0.9% expansion for the currency block, narrowly avoiding a recession. Germany didn't look so great, but we'll get to that in just a moment. Paolo Gentiloni, the European Commissioner, spoke about the forecast.
First, the good news. So the EU economy entered this year on a healthier footing than expected and looks set to escape recession. Since autumn, the economy has seen a number of positive developments. The European gas benchmark price has fallen below its pre-war level, helped by demand restraints, diversification of supply sources, and of course also the mild weather. Better than previously expected turnout for growth at the end of last year and improving economic sentiment suggests that the EU economy is thus set to narrowly escape the technical recession that was projected back in autumn.
That was Paolo Gentiloni, the European Commissioner, talking about the European Commission's outlook. Let's get more on this. Well, first of all, apparently, Eddie wants to do a victory lap. Yeah. Okay.
I do want to do a victory lap.
Just the one.
I want high fives all round because when I was last on this show, I was banging the European drum very loudly. And I was very excited about the idea that, European energy prices will start coming down. China growth will come back as the economy reopens. And lo and behold, that is what we're seeing this year.
And we all thought you were crazy.
However,
by the way.
Everybody thought I was crazy. I mean, you know what? But 90% of the time I am wrong. So just let me have this one time when I am right. But look, I think Europe still has a lot of, they're still, 0.9% is not something to really be doing a victory lap over, but at least it's not a recession. So, you know, look on the bright side.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. And usually I'm always wrong too. So I don't know where that puts us right now. But let's get someone who maybe is righter than us. David Powell, he's a Bloomberg senior Euro area economist, joins us now. So, David, is this a legit victory lap? Like, is Europe totally out of the woods?
I would say it's not really a complete victory lap. We also have to remember that the European commissioners, whose quote we just heard, Mr. Gentiloni, also said better than expected doesn't mean good. And so while he highlighted that that energy prices have declined to a pre-war level, we have to remember that in the run-up to the war, Russia had been restricting gas exports to Europe. So in the run-up to war, they were rising quite a bit. So even if we're back to where they were when the war started, they're still very high relative to the kind of couple of years before that, and that's still acting as a weight on the euro area economy as real consumption is restricted by it.
Right. So European energy prices, therefore, potentially has a lot more downside because if you're saying European prices remain, gas prices remain significantly higher than they were in the pre-war period, then therefore do we see a disinflationary force there coming through?
Well, all you have to do is pull up on the Bloomberg a chart of European gas prices. You can see they rose quite a bit in the run-up to the war. Russia was restricting those exports, and people were kind of wondering why they were doing that, and traders were pricing in higher prices. They then shot up after the war began, and then they came down. So we're going to see that pattern repeated in the inflation data that we get. So inflation has already peaked in the euro area and will likely continue to drop over the course of this year as those increases in energy prices that we already witnessed dropped out of the equation. But it's important to remember, it is still very high. The reading for January had headline inflation at 8.5 and core was above 5, and that's still acting as a drag on real growth.
So here's my other problem. German growth wasn't great, and I don't understand how you were going to see some real stabilization in Europe if you don't have Germany reaccelerating.
Well, Germany is particularly vulnerable to high energy prices because, going into this war, a lot of gas that went into Germany came from Russia. That's not the case with all countries. For example, Spain had very few energy imports from Russia, really for just geographic reasons. It got most of its energy imports from other places, such as Africa. So the level, the extent to which each of these economies are affected by energy prices differs. And also remember that Germany's the industrial heartland of Europe, and industrial companies are very dependent on energy to produce goods like cars and other things that are used, whereas other economies within the euro area, such as Italy or Spain, for example, are more dependent on tourism, and tourism is not nearly as energy intensive.
Yeah, true. All right, David, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. David Powell joining us on European Growth. Speaking of, I think that's what Guy's doing, Eddie. He's skiing in Italy.
Oh, lovely. I wish I could go. I've never been skiing. But
I've never been skiing.
But I grew up in South Africa. We don't get a lot of snow out there. However, it's easy. I can get behind this European growth story.
Okay.
I do think I'm excited about this.
Hang to that thought, Eddie. We'll be back in a second. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Eddie Vandervolt joins me over in the UK. So apparently, I hear that sports are a thing over there. Like, you know, football's a thing. You play with your feet, not like football here where you play with your hands. Apparently, Qatari investors are set to make an offer for Manchester United in the coming days, is according to people familiar with the matter. This would be huge. I mean, the numbers that I like are bandied about are anywhere between like $5 and $8 billion. I don't know. How do you guys feel about that over there? I mean, I'm assuming you know things about football, but like, is that a big deal? Like, is that dramatic? I mean, these are huge numbers.
Ooh, I mean, Manchester United is a global institution, right?
Sure.
And Qatar is making Qatar, you know, who's potentially bidding for this. I think there's, in the Middle East, there's real excitement about football. Mm-hmm. There's a real drive. They've just had the World Cup. Mm-hmm. There's a real drive to get behind this sport with a round ball and, you know, and really throw their money at it and develop a system. Mm-hmm. How the European football fan feels about it, that is a different question.
Okay, so let's get to that. David Hellyer of Bloomberg joins us now. There's a lot of things to break through with this, but how do the fans feel about this, David?
If you talk about Manchester United fans specifically, I mean, they're very happy about any new owner because they've had a really tortured relationship with the current owners, the Glazer family, who they felt weren't really putting enough money into the club and didn't really have the club's interests at heart. Something which the Glazers, you know, feel very bitter about.
David, I mean, fair enough. You know, at least they're getting new owners. But is it a case of better the devil you know here? Because the Qatari family, not calling them devils, but the Qatari money will come with its own problems, of course. Because you know there were questions, of course, about human rights when we were looking at the football World Cup in Qatar, and then you've got there's a lot of other questions. What would they want to do with the club? Would they even see to rehouse it or something like that? So are the fans feeling secure?
No, I mean football fans never feel secure unless they've won trophy. No, they're not feeling secure. So I really think that we in the media care very much about human rights. I argue that football fans just want to win trophies, and you know that they want owners that are going to pursue those objectives just as they want them to be. They're very insecure about what's going on. But as I said, I think the overriding feeling is, we just want to get rid of the Glazers. Mm-hmm. I mean, that comes. I've talked to quite a few, fan channels, and I mean, the one thing they're more worried about than human rights is debt levels and stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's been their real issue with the Glazers. That the Glazers have indebted Man United. They've taken dividends out of the club. I mean, the Glazers would argue, and some of them, even their critics would argue that they've also spent a lot of money on players and. In order for Man United to perform on the pitch, but the fans themselves are really obsessed with debt, with the amount of debt. So they quite like one of the rival bidders, Jim Ratcliffe. He's a Manchester businessman, a wealthy guy, $13.5 billion, according to Bloomberg's index of wealthiest people. But they're worried that he won't really have sufficient funds. I mean, football is just so cash absorbent, and even a rich man like he has got, he's up against the UAE state with Man City, and Newcastle with the PIF sovereign wealth fund.
Hey, David, we've got to leave it there. David Hellyer joining us. I mean, $4 to $8 billion, like that's a pretty big spread if you're gonna put money into this thing. All right, coming up, we're gonna talk more about favorite topic, Brexit. How much it's costing households, and what Sunak can do about it. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Eddie Vanderbilt joins me in London. Guy Johnson is off today. Okay, let's get to the topic that everyone loves talking about, and that's politics and Brexit. You know you'd like it. Apparently, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has privately asked senior ministers and officials to draw up plans for rebuilding the UK's relations with the European Union. Joined now by Joe Mays. He covers Bloomberg politics for us in the UK. Joe, are these real? Are these real sentences? Is this a thing?
Yes, it very much is. I think that there's a realisation that's happened at the top of the UK government, led by Rishi Sunak and informed by his Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, that there does need to be a reset with the European Union. We've had these years of acrimony. I think they see the geopolitical landscape is one where you'd rather be friends with your biggest neighbour than not when you've got, you know, increasingly powerful and authoritarian China, you have the war in Ukraine, you know, you've had the pandemic. You know, these are tough times to be kind of out on your own. So, yes, no, this is happening.
Eddie, are you there? Do you not want to talk
Hello,
about Brexit?
I'm sorry. It does sound like a sensible thing.
He wants to avoid Brexit.
To
he's going
to
not talk this whole segment.
Exactly. I was just zoning it out. Look, it does seem like a sensible thing to do, right? You've got this giant neighbor. You're going to have to do. You're going to have to have some sort of relationship with this neighbor. But at the same time, this is politically toxic, right? Because the hardline Brexiteers will just balk at anything that sounds like a soft Brexit or a sellout.
And yeah, that's always been the difficulty for Conservative prime ministers. And notice how the last two, Boris Johnson and Liz Truss, were brought down by their own MPs. And Rishi Sunak, you know, he is alive to that prospect. And that's the wing of the party that's probably most sceptical of him. It is that kind of pro-Brexit wing. And so he has some difficult obstacles coming up. He's trying to get a deal over the line with respect to the Northern Ireland Protocol, which has been a key thorn in the side of the UK-EU relationship. But, you know, that pro-Brexit wing will be watching very closely for, does he make too large concessions to the EU? And that's going to be a very difficult political job for him to sell. As we report in our story, he's looking at closer defence ties with the EU. Again, something that the pro-Brexit wing is quite sceptical of. So, yeah, it's a political obstacle course that's tricky for Sunak to navigate, for sure.
Okay, so how does he navigate it? Like, now what happens? Like, this is out there. So what's going to be the response since we're like, what's the next part of this?
I think Rishi Sunak is ultimately taking the view that he thinks he does have enough power in the party to kind of take on that pro-Brexit wing, which is slightly diminishing in size. And I think he has that confidence that he will ultimately win out. So that's why I think we can expect to see a deal on UK on the Northern Ireland Protocol perhaps next week. And he will, effectively try to face down that part of his party. And then when it comes to things like defence, work with officials and kind of present it as a fair compli to his party. Say, look, here's this better relationship. I'm the Prime Minister. You know, we're not going to change leader again, are we? That'll be absolutely, you know, that's a very silly thing to do. Back me and let's move forward. I think that's what his plans are going to be.
Right, absolutely. And surely there is reason for optimism, because there can't be much appetite within the Conservative Party for another leadership election before the next election in the UK, right? They must start to see this as damaging, and therefore they are forced into a corner backing Sunak.
I think so. I think there's still a very small vocal minority which says, oh, you know, bring back Boris Johnson, for example. And if the polls are really bad, they might say, you know, why not roll the dice one more time? I think the overwhelming majority of the party in the space will say, look, we would look completely ridiculous if we did that. And there is still a path to victory in their heads for Rishi Sunak. They think that, you know, if the economy does turn for the better, perhaps next year, and there's been a sensible, stable period, maybe voters will say, okay, maybe we'll vote for the Tories again. They do think there's a sliver of a chance, and that involves sticking with Sunak, not changing leader again.
Do we have a sense of how the public actually feels about it? So I really like this other piece. A Bank of England policymaker apparently has said that Brexit dealt the UK economy a blow worth about £1,000 per household. Like, these are real numbers, they're tangible numbers. Does the public care?
I mean, we are seeing consistent polling, which says that the majority of people think that Brexit was either a mistake or indeed has been handled badly. So even if you think it was right at the time to vote out, it's been handled in such a way that it's made things worse. So I think, no, there definitely is that public view which things need to change. And again, that's probably kind of emboldening Sunak to be slightly more open to closer ties with the EU. The big question for the opposition Labour Party, will they take a more anti-Brexit line? They've been reticent to do so. They're very burned in 2019, obviously, you remember, where, you know, they lost an election because of their Brexit stance in part. So, yeah, we're definitely seeing that the tectonic plates of British politics are shifting away from Brexit, and that worries the hardline Brexiteers.
Okay, fine. People are less, or, you know, the sentiment has shifted away from Brexit, but has the attention shifted away from Brexit too? Is the attention in the UK not much more focused on strikes these days, and on the NHS, and rather than, you know, what I'm saying is, do people just want to move on and talk about something else other than Brexit?
Or is this personal? And is that what actually anyone wants to do?
No, I think there's a lot of truth in that. I think that people have, broadly speaking, moved on from the argument. But and no one is seriously making the case for rejoin at this point. That's not a serious prospect. You're right. It is strikes. It is the NHS. It's the cost of living crisis. It's energy bills. It's all that stuff. But you know, in the background at all times, we see the Brexit effects kind of permeating, whether that be poor investment, whether we see, you know, the trade deficit with the EU widening, you know, whether we see our growth has been worse than any other, you know, G7 country. We haven't reached our pre-pandemic size, unlike the rest of the G7. You know, and then Brexit is always invoked because it has had those negative economic effects. So it's there in the background at all times, I'd say.
Yeah, and also to the point that, like, this was supposed to be UK being awesome. Like, you're finally can do your own thing, and this should be the time where labor's great, wages are great, companies are investing, everything's wonderful, and it's just not the case. What is Europe doing? Like, who is Sunak talking? Like, what is going to be the response to Europe for this kind of headline?
Yeah, I mean, the most immediate way in which this story has an effect is when it comes to that negotiation over Northern Ireland. And I think it shows that at the top of the government, there has been a step change in the UK's attitudes towards the EU, with very hostile under Boris Johnson, continue to Liz Truss. So that's the immediate effect. I think that the EU now thinks that they have someone they can deal with, and therefore, you know, there could be, you know, a pretty significant breakthrough agreement coming on Northern Ireland. And that would potentially unlock further discussions in other areas, whether that be defence, you know, whether there be other forms of cooperation, whether it's like migrant crossings, for example. That's another issue where Rishi wants to build political capital with the EU to help them cooperate to stop those crossings. So, yeah.
Joe, good stuff. Really appreciate Joe Mays joining us there. We'll go from one political quagmire to another. We'll talk about the U.S. and China and balloons next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You are listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Eddie Vandervoort joins me over in the UK. Guy is somewhere. You think he's skiing somewhere in Italy. U.S. markets, I'm going to say kind of crazy because it kind of is. S&P is up a full 1 percentage point. NASDAQ up 1.5%. Volume's terrible. I mean, volume for the S&P is 23% below its 10-day moving average. And a huge part of the rally in the NASDAQ is Microsoft getting a couple upgrades from some analysts who are pretty positive about 2024. Great. But we're in 2023, and we're in the beginning of 2023. The sentiment and the concerns really don't mesh up with the rally that we continue to see in stocks. And Eddie, it also brings up questions as to, you know, how we're positioned into CPI and like where the risk reward actually is in the market.
I know we're going to talk about inflation later, but look, this market is so dovish in its reaction function, right? If the Fed makes 5 hawkish noises and 1 dovish noise, this market will pick out the 1 dovish noise and just trade off of that. We've seen that all of this year. I think that sets up a big risk for later in the year if we get a surprise. But I know we'll talk about inflation later.
Yeah, I liken it to my kid. Like, she hears what she wants to hear. Moving on. All right, that's a quick snapshot. We will get to that in just a moment. Charlie Pell is still here with
and
some headlines.
Here's what's going on, Alex Steele. 4 in 10 renters moving homes in London last year chose to leave the city as pricey monthly payments squeeze budgets to the limit. More than 90,000 rental households left London in 2022, according to a report from the broker Hamptons International. That is the most in more than a decade and more than double the amount that moved from the city in 2012. NatWest Group has agreed to acquire 85% of Cushion, that is the workplace and pensions financial tech company. The British lender is paying £144 million for the majority stake. Large steel mills in southern Turkey are expected to remain shut for weeks, with production lines idle and workers trying to cope with the impact of the massive twin earthquakes that shook the region. Sources tell Bloomberg Qatari investors are set to make an offer for Manchester United in coming days in a move that would cement the country's desire to become a major player in global sports. Those sources say the Qatari consortium is preparing to submit an initial bid for the Premier League football team by the end of the week. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
All right, Charlie, thank you so very much. Let's get to that other random risk out there, and that is an escalated confrontation between the U.S. and China. I say random because rewind a week ago, and we had no idea that there were balloons somewhere in the atmosphere from China that the U.S. and Canada were going to have to shoot down. The latest headline, apparently, is Secretary of State Antony Blinken is considering meeting with his Chinese counterpart at a security conference later this week. It would be the first face-to-face talk since a Chinese balloon had led to a huge news spike in confrontation between the two countries. Joining us now for more is Nick Wadhams, national security reporter for Bloomberg. All right, basic. Nick, give us the latest. Are they going to meet? What does that tell us?
Well, we know they're exploring a meeting. And essentially what this appears to be is, you know, Secretary Blinken canceled that trip to Beijing he had planned to do last week. He didn't want to be over there. They thought the optics would just look too bad of him being in Beijing, shaking hands with Chinese leader while there was a Chinese spy balloon floating over U.S. territory. Now it looks like they're trying a little bit to get things back on track, try to at least get talking again and see if they can do what President Joe Biden had promised to do, which was set a floor under the relationship, as they put it, keep things from getting any worse.
But look, I really like this story, but I'm curious, right? Superpowers spy on one another. We know this, right? This isn't new. They used to do this with satellites. I feel like it's a step down going to balloons. What changed? What has really changed? Why is it different that China is using this seemingly obscure technology to spy on the US rather than putting satellites in space to see what's happening on, in North America?
Well, I mean, some of it is just sort of the weirdness of the whole situation. You know, we're not talking about hypersonic missiles or aircraft carriers or super high-tech satellites. We're talking about a slow-moving 200-foot-tall balloon. And in some ways, it's almost like the audacity of it, you know, that they would send something like this over U.S. airspace where it was actually visible from the ground. The other thing is, obviously, perhaps, you know, not at all surprisingly, it's been turned into this political bickering point in the U.S. where, you know, Biden didn't shoot it down early enough, according to Republicans. Now they're saying he's trigger happy because he's shooting down all these other objects. So it's sort of been caught up in the hurly-burly of the U.S. political system, and that's just made things even more of a hash.
Shocker,
right? But
go ahead.
Sorry, Alex.
Yeah, no, go for it.
No, I was just gonna say it does feel like a step down in technology, doesn't it? Right? Because I mean, it's a bit like when we went from Concorde and, you know, hypersonic interatlantic travel, and then suddenly we went back to slower planes. It's a bit like that. I mean, it doesn't feel like a massive increase in technology. Or is this something they can do with balloons that they can't do from space?
Well, so this is one of the things we don't know, and this is where the Biden administration is really going to have to show that there's proof of the freak out. And, you know, there is some speculation that these balloons did serve a very specific purpose, which was essentially they could relay with satellites, so they could hover over a particular site, pick up ground communication, use sensors that were not available on a satellite. Then they could link up with a satellite and direct that satellite to point to scrutinize a particular place with those, you know, very, very high-focus cameras. So we're still trying to figure out what exactly the technology is, but U.S. officials say that, yes, it is possible to put a particular type of sensor array on these balloons that could help China gain information it wouldn't necessarily get from satellites. And communications is really one of the big ones there, that it could pick up ground signals over these sensitive military sites. But you're right, there's a lot there we don't know.
So I understand, like, the headlines don't look great. I do feel, though, that if we just take a step back, is the U.S. militarily prepared for bad things? And I say that because the war with Russia and Ukraine sees no signs of ending.
Right.
The weapon move to Ukraine just keeps happening. If something happens with Taiwan, like, is the U.S. ready for something like this?
Well, that's what's so crazy about this whole situation, you know, because the U.S. Defense budget is like $850 billion a year, and there is so much hardware. And then it's like, wait a minute, we're stymied by a balloon. And it's like, and we had this call with the Pentagon last night that was pretty extraordinary, because what they basically admitted was, we've shot down all this other stuff in the last few days because we've retrained our radars. So instead of looking, you know, above 50,000 feet at really big objects, we've retrained them to look at slow moving objects lower. And it's like, wait a minute, there's a ton of stuff there. So does that mean we're just going to be blasting every random object out of the sky with a $500,000 missile, you know, and like, where does this go? And they were basically like, we don't know the answer to that question. That is a policy decision. We're waiting on policymakers to tell us what to do about all this junk that's floating around up there.
So there was this great piece today from Niall Ferguson talking about the awareness gap, and the awareness gap that that Russia had in 1987 when suddenly a plane landed on Red Square. Mm-hmm. Is this similar? Is this a moment where we're realizing there is all this stuff out there that we hadn't thought of?
Nick, you got like 15 seconds.
We have to think about.
I think there is an element of that, but now that they're going to really scrutinize that stuff, they're determined to close that gap very quickly.
Oh, fair enough, Nick. Wonderful reporting. Thank you very much, Nick Wadhams, joining us from Bloomberg. All right, coming up, we'll get to the main event, and that's CPI. We'll get the preview, we'll get the hedge at the trade, what hedge funds are doing. We're going to get all of it for you. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Eddie Vandervelt joins me over in the UK. The day tomorrow, 8:30 a.m. here in the U.S. 2:30? What's 5 plus 8? 3:30. 3:30 over in the UK. Man, math is hard on the top of your head. looking at the CPI number for January, expectation is, if you back out food and energy, for it to rise to 0.4% on a year-on-year level, 6.2%. Let's get the read with Mike McKee, Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent. All right, Mike, walk us through kind of the whispers. Walk us through the consensus.
Well, you just gave the consensus there, which has not changed a whole lot, but everybody in the market seems to accept the fact that the risk is to the upside for this CPI. Some of the better analysts who have looked at this say it's really hard to tell because of the various cross currents going into it. I mean, we know some things went up in price. Energy prices for some energies, goods, gasoline, for example, went up. Natural gas went down, but gasoline went up. Used car prices went up during January at the wholesale level. It sometimes takes a couple months, though, to get into the retail level. So it's hard to know what impact that's going to have. Everybody, of course, waiting to see what the housing impact is. When do we start to see that start to come down? But then you also have the statistical adjustments they're doing, the seasonals that were changed last week. It pushed up the December CPI numbers, and then they're changing the weights in various sectors to better account for what people are spending on in a more timely basis. So it's kind of hard to tell, to give you a number, but to give you the direction, the risk is to the upside.
Yeah, I think, but this market has been gearing for downside surprises, and I've been getting them for the most part recently. But the Fed has been telling us that, look, watch out, because inflation remains sticky. We may have to continue hiking rates. We may even have to take it higher than people are expecting right now. The market has so far not been paying attention. Are we set up for that big shock if we do get that one big upside reading?
That's the question. I don't think the Fed, on the basis of one upside reading, will make any changes. You'll probably get, when the numbers come out, we're going to be speaking live with the Richmond Fed president, Tom Barkin. And then we've got several other Fed officials speaking during this week. I don't think they changed what they've been saying about how it's going to be a longer fight than people have anticipated, and they've got to raise rates more and leave them high. The issue is, what do they do when they get to their next meeting? But that's two CPI reports from now and a PCE report from now. So one number isn't going to change the Fed's view. Does it change the market's view? That's an interesting question. A lot of people that we've had on Bloomberg TV the last couple of days have said, well, we're anticipating the possibility of an upside surprise. So I don't know if it's priced in or not.
It's hard to see how positioning is and how clean the read is going to be. What's more important, jobs Friday or tomorrow?
Interesting question, because it depends on where you think inflation is coming from. If you're thinking it's a broad-based phenomenon, you're looking at tomorrow and looking at the CPI report. If you think it's a wage-based phenomenon, which the Fed sort of seems it does at this point, then you care about what's happening in the jobs report. I'd put, you know, 50% weight on both probably, because we don't have enough clarity into exactly what's going on to know whether it's wages or broad-based. I mean, there've been improvements on both sides. So at this point, you got to tune into Bloomberg on both days.
Yeah, no, true. Nice shameless. There's a lot of plugs there. That was turned to Bloomberg. Watch Mike break the news. We got Barkin tomorrow. Yeah. So there's lots of plugs happening for Mike McKee. We appreciate this. All right, thanks very much, Michael McKee, Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent. All right, so let's talk about the positioning. Let's talk about where we are in the market and what the clean read is going to be and how to take it, how to hedge it, all that great stuff. We're going to talk to Mark Connors. He's a 3IQ Corp head of research, and he also has been tracking for decades like what hedge funds do and how they're positioned. We'll break that down with him next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Eddie Vandervelt is over in the UK. We're just about 20 hours away, maybe a little bit less, from the CPI number. Let's game it all out. JP Morgan has some like four different scenarios depending on the reading and what it winds up meaning for the S&P. Let's get the insight. Mark Connors, 3IQ Corp head of research, joins us to talk about that. Hey, Mark, it's good to chat with you. Thanks for joining.
Hey, Alex, thanks. Yes, always enjoy, especially ahead of a big number.
Okay, so what are we looking like? How is market positioned? Like, what's going to be your big thesis going into tomorrow morning?
Is buy vol and buy delta. We think that we are in one of the more confusing markets. Unemployment, U.S., blew out numbers, confused people. Canada had it on Friday as well, 150 versus 15,000. You know, smaller market, but, you know, neighbor from a trade standpoint. And, you know, you extend that to even Goldman Sachs having mea culpas and hiring too many people. So what we look at from a market standpoint is one of the best risk barometers is the S&P versus the 10-year. Now, our team, I've been using it since 07. It has a very strong signal power. And we think it does because with the S&P being the risk-on asset and the 10-year historically the safe haven, when there are sharp changes in positioning, we actually see it in the correlation change. So what it flashed last week was that we're probably two-thirds of the way through hitting a very strong risk-off signal. And so that's why we wanted to have this call with you to say we don't see this often. The markets are confusing. We don't think it's priced in.
Okay. I love this idea because I think that the only way to make sense of this market is looking at you know, something like volatility, because it's very hard to predict whether the market's going to be wrong on its positioning. But what I do want to know is, do you think that the risks are symmetrical around the number? Do you think that there is potentially a bigger move if we see an upside reading to inflation than there is upside to the NASDAQ, say, if there is another downside surprise?
I don't think the NASDAQ risk on trade has legs. That really has to bear out over time because of the persistent 5% number. So I think NASDAQ could get faded, you know, on a surprise print to the downside on inflation. I'm not the only one. So, you know, call that, I would say, it's pretty much consensus camp on the NASDAQ. And on the downside, yeah, that probably does have a little more legs. So I think we're skewed to the downside. That's a fundamental opinion, but our signal's separate. When we have such a confusing market where you have a minus 82 inverted curve, on the one end, you have a pretty okay earnings season and persistent you know, equities being really persistent, and especially in Europe, bifurcated markets, you have to go from dead reckoning to instrumentation. You have to bring your attention closer to positioning and cross-market correlations, which I think are even better than volatility, because volatility is about prices. Correlations are about movement and positioning. So that's our opinion. And, yeah, I think it's going to be a wonderful day to get popcorn and hey, watch this number. Because
Mark, based on that, if you're eating popcorn, what asset are you watching? Like, would you tune into the FX movie? Would you turn into the rates movie, the equity movie, the commodities movie?
Yeah, I think people will be looking at the at their euro dollars for sure. Those are great for short term. I mean, the short term interest rate traders, the stir traders, usually get things right. Equity guys get confused. Stir traders ask them what's going to happen on a certain number. So that's, you know, call the March, June, and December, not March, the June, December, and March 24. Euro dollars would probably be the first place to look. That'll be the fastest to move.
I get that this is really important for the market and for market positioning. But, you know, we just heard from Mike McKee. Does this change the Fed's reaction function? If we get to this one number, unless it's a blowout one way or another, but if we see, you know, slightly upwards, you know, a slightly hot reading for inflation, does that change what the Fed's going to do?
No, I don't think so. The Fed has committed to, it's a reputational factor right now. They got it wrong at the end of last year, beginning of this year, and they have to stay the course. I think that's why when we started the top of this call talking about unemployment, we started with that because we agree that inflation is one of the most difficult things once it starts to really gauge. You don't understand the behavior. No one has the data. So you don't know about wage push. And we think there's the initial information coming through the marketplace, again, back to Goldman, saying, hey, we're firing, we overhired, we're going to continue to fire. So we think that people are going to be, that wage inflation is is the most important thing to watch. And we think it's starting to show signs of not heating up because of productivity gains at companies. So that's our 5 cents on looking down the road, because you have to. Very difficult markets to trade here.
Yeah.
And you have to have an opinion longer term.
Biggest misprice right now? Thing you're most worried about?
Probably the thing I'm most worried about is treasury market functioning. Something that you guys have mentioned, some other folks have. We have become very narrow in our ownership of treasuries. Fewer reserves, bigger repo balances, reverse repo held by the Fed. So more assets held by fewer people makes for instability. So that's the number one thing I'm concerned about in the marketplace. It's just too big to fail.
Okay. As a commodities guy, I have to ask you, is gold going to offer you protection against rising inflation here, or, you know, or faster, continued faster inflation? Or is it the real rates trade that you have to be worried about as a gold investor?
You have to worry about real rates. Gold has befuddled people for way too long. It's such a digital function, like it's just stepwise. So I'm not as good there now. And I don't know if you can tell by our title, but we're at a digital asset manager. I do believe that there's some, you know, promise in Bitcoin. But look at hard assets versus dollar. That's the trade. You just have to be away from bonds still, I think. So that's
Mark.
My call.
Mark, love having you on. Come back. We'll get you back on TV2, Mark Connors, 3IQ. Hey, thank you, Eddie. Well, you'll be here tomorrow as well. Good luck, everybody. This is Bloomberg.